And good morning to you all. I was just thinking how amazing it is, you know, that so many people have been so consistently, or even sort of consistently inconsistently, showing up to practice for so long in this way. Man, you know, it's been a long time. And now the weather's finally really great, and here you still are. So I really hope that you'll all go outside after this, because it's just so glorious and unusual for April to be this glorious. So maybe we'll even be grateful when the showers come to bring us more flowers. Happy Poetry Month. April is Poetry Month. And I just Googled to see, like, who decided that. And it's a little unclear, but it seems like the both in the States and here, the national poetry bodies. I see in the States it's called the League of... No, here it's called the League of Canadian Poets. And in the States it's called something else. I guess they declared it, but I don't know when they declared it. But it's Poetry Month. And I guess probably because spring, it's spring, and spring has yielded so much poetry over the many centuries and millennia. And it's also Earth Day this Thursday. And we do know when Earth Day was started. It was in 1970. So last year, it was marked the 50-year anniversary, and there was a lot of press around that. And it was, but I forgot. You know, last year I looked it up, and I forgot. I looked it up again. Earth Day was initiated by a Wisconsin senator whose name was Gaylord Nelson. To bring attention to the fact that there was, at that time, no Environmental Protection Agency, no Clean Air or Clean Water Act in the States. And this was, so there were, at that time, quite large protests to bring that into awareness, and with good results. And the tradition has continued for over 50 years now. And at Mountain Rain, for, I don't know, I forget how many years we've called April Earth Care Month, and we've had a little market out in the entry hall of the Zendo where we have sold some lovely items and some perhaps less than lovely items that we haven't needed around our homes to raise money. And each year we've raised money, sometimes quite, you know, a nice sum. That we've donated to various local, tended to choose local smaller organizations that practice earth care in some way, and they often send us really lovely little cards of gratitude, and we didn't do that last year because we couldn't have a market, and we won't be able to this year either. Which is really sad because it's a sort of fun thing to do. And but what we are going to do, our Engaged Buddhist Practice Group is going to show a film this Thursday called The Story of Plastic and give us some ideas and initiatives to bring awareness to our use of plastic, both individually and collectively, because, you know, as much as we can try and recycle plastic and the four R's, right? Reuse, recycle, reduce, and there's an additional one, which is refuse, right? As much as we do that on an individual basis, there's still massive use of plastic in industrial levels, you know, large scale levels. That needs to be addressed. We just, in passing, listening to the radio yesterday heard something that I can't double check. I didn't double check, but the amount of plastic particles in the air that we are breathing in, and I didn't know that. I knew about the water and I knew about, you know, food, but the air, which was really sobering. So in the face of the magnitude, the magnitude of that human created problem of trashing the body, trashing the body of the earth, which is our body, the magnitude of that, it is so easy to feel. What can I do? You know, what can I as a little person do? And it's really the wrong question, I feel, because it is a question that reifies the separate self, you know, our sense of me. What can I do? So I'd like us to consider what larger questions we can ask, and how we can respond. And I was talking to Vicky, who's one of the committee members or group members who's organizing this plastics initiative for us, about that very question. You know, here we've been over a year, isolated, not connecting as strongly to collective action. You know, we can't even go to an Earth Day march, right? What message are we giving people to show a film that will have this sort of, I feel at least, a bodily impact when I see, it has a bodily impact on me when I walk around my own block and pick up the trash, and pick up the plastic. It's like, if I don't, it'll feel like not brushing my own teeth. It just feels grotty. So why do we, what message do we want to give by showing a film that's going to make, that risks making people feel disempowered by the magnitude? So I don't have any easy answer to that, but I'm going to, in fact, these days poetry is pretty much what makes sense to me. So I'm going to share some poetry with you, and it's going to be, I'm really going to call upon our Zen poet, extended Sangha, Zen poet sister Jane Hirschfield to help me, because a couple of months ago I took an online poetry workshop with her, hosted by Minnesota Zen Center, and it was a day-long workshop, and it was so wonderful. Very nourishing for me. And I heard her read a couple of poems that really speak to our predicament, you know, the what can I do predicament. So I'm going to draw on some of her poems, and I'm going to read to you some excerpts from an interview with Jane Hirschfield in Tricycle Magazine, which also addresses some of these questions. But first I'm going to read a poem that she wrote just after the inauguration of Donald Trump in 2017. And at the time, what was really up strongly for her was the environmental crisis and climate change and all that entails, the climate crisis. So this is what she wrote. Let them not say, we did not see it. We saw. Let them not say, we did not hear it. We heard. Let them not say, they did not taste it. we ate, we trembled. Let them not say, it was not spoken, not written. We spoke, we witnessed with voices and hands. Let them not say, they did nothing. We did not enough. Let them say, as they must say something, a kerosene beauty, it burned. Let them say we warmed ourselves by it, read by its light, praised, and it burned. So she speaks, of course, to the inescapable paradox and ambiguity of our situation, of caring from our deepest hearts, of not doing enough, of watching the earth burn, of the very, you know, substance that we heat our homes with and power our vehicles with. And yet, we cannot not care. In the interview, Jane Hirschfield says that she's talking about, in response to her most recent book, which just came out, and it's called Ledger. You know, because at this time, we're kind of taking stock. We're holding ourselves accountable. So she uses this image of the Ledger book. And she says, during the years when I was writing Ledger, which is pretty much the last 5 years, the crisis of the biosphere went from something imagined as future to something current, arrived. I waited in it for weeks, calf deep on the paths of a Florida Gulf Coast island, 5 feet above sea level at its highest spine. The sheer groundslip of culture, the seeming failure of the social contract, shifted this book as well. And then, skipping a little bit, she says, for answerable questions, we have mathematics, science, engineering, all the immense machinery of caretaking that we humans have devised to keep ourselves fed, clothed, housed, cloaked in the folds of community and culture. Poetry and spiritual teachings, philosophy, the other arts, are how we approach questions unanswerable in other ways. Yeah, so we're in this territory of unanswerable questions. And that question, what can I do, is an unanswerable question because it almost cancels itself out. Because what am I? Who am I? She continues, I write to meet my life and the world's lives fully with my own eyes. The pupils widen further when they look for a new phrase, a new gesture. I need this impractical, unmeasurable, sometimes startling experience. Need its capacity to make visible and audible the wholeness of heart that can be present even in fear, even in grief. To allow me to touch my life's fabric. Poems also show us that we are not alone, not passive, not helpless, not without choice, whatever the circumstance. Even in the face of what seems unchangeable, by writing it down, we change it, and we change ourselves. Right? And the Buddha taught, you know, the thought affects the speech affects the action effect becomes the habit pattern. You know, so in expressing, giving expression, and in this case through poetry, but it might be in other ways, that giving expression, we start to turn it. And that's why Dogen always speaks not only of practice, but practice and realization, practice and realization being not separate. The third is actualization. Practice, realization, and actualization are one. Of course, Jane Hirschfield, for those who may not know, is a very long time Zen practitioner in our own lineage, and spent about 3 years when she was quite young practicing at Tassajara. She says, the practices of poetry, of Zen, and of daily life feel for me continuous. I bring to each the same hands, the same set of hopes and intentions, to know the world and not obstruct it, to sustain openness to what is, to bring forth in body, speech, and mind an original expression of the life and world and age I've been given to carry. Notice she says, the life and world and age I've been given to carry. So each of you has been given to carry your particular life at this particular time and place in the world. And no one else can carry that for you. Each of us, you know, that's the paradox. We are always connected, but no one else can do it for us. She says, to act with an awareness of interconnection, to lessen rather than add to suffering, to glimpse a few times in my life the full abundance of being and beyond being, to know existence directly, to live with these ears and eyes unconfined by the bell jar of the narrow self, but also to treasure that small self, to care for it as we would care for any small, fragile being, any carpenter's chisel, any washed bowl set carefully down. So this body, right, this particular life is our tool, and we must care for it well. She continues, the practice of Zazen awakens many things, among them courage. Meditation trains courage, and it encourages. Zen's formal practice has given me sustenance and tools, meditation, mindfulness, silence, certain stories and koans, the precepts, the paramitas, the simple, helpful stubbornness of vow and intention. Also, a basic stance of humility and non-grasping, keeping a don't-know mind, is one useful antidote to despair. So there you have it. She sums up our toolkit, right? We've often referred to our sort of set of practice as a toolkit, or a scaffolding is another image I like to use. The night of the 2016 election, I asked myself, what might be a right practice response to this unfathomable to me choice my fellow country persons had made? The answer that came, do what you have been doing, only harder. Do what you have been doing, only harder. I've kept asking the question, and thus far the answer has stayed the same. Part of that is continuing to honor interiority and non-doing, and to trust in the seemingly peripheral life of poem writing, as well as activism. Our culture values visible doing, but the heart also needs non-doing. Part of that is recognizing the perfection of things as they are even now. Part is keeping the humility of a don't-know mind. Part is bringing forward the values of kinship and shared fate, and of compassion and interconnection. And part two has been a vow to take some daily action. Action is equally an antidote to despair, and beginning with the day of the 2017 inauguration, my practice has included taking action each day, large or small, without weighing its practical outcome. So sometimes we get tripped up by thinking we have to, like, you know, start a new organization or do something big and dramatic, you know. But no matter how small, it tips the balance and flows outward. no matter how small. Former Czech President Václav Havel's sentence stays close. She quotes, "Work for something because it is good, not just because it stands a chance to succeed." So I'm going to read you another poem now. Because, of course, you know, when we've, during these times when we've been quite isolated and asked to stay home, it really does sometimes feel like, what can I do, you know? So here's what Jane Hirschfield wrote. Today, when I could do nothing, I saved an ant. It must have come in with the morning paper, still being delivered to those who shelter in place. A morning paper is still an essential service. I am not an essential service. I have coffee and books, time, a garden, silence enough to fill cisterns. It must have first walked the morning paper as if loosened ink, taking the shape of an ant, then across the laptop computer, warm, then onto the back of a cushion. Small black ant alone, crossing a navy cushion, moving steadily because that is what it could do. Set outside in the sun, it could not have found again its nest. What then did I save? It did not move as if it was frightened, even while walking my hand, which moved it through swiftness and air. Ant, alone, without companions, whose ant heart I could not fathom. How is your life? I wanted to ask. I lifted it. I took it outside. This first day, when I could do nothing, contribute nothing, beyond staying distant from my own kind, I did this. Sometimes doing nothing or doing almost nothing is what we are doing. Our offer, you know, when we are staying home, distant from our kind, that's what we are offering. You know, we're offering care in that way. That is a doing too. Well, her poem reminded me of a poem I wrote about 3 years ago. And it's about my mom, so I'm going to read it to you, if you would be so kind as to listen. And this poem is called Not Yet. When I arrive from across the continent, my mother has stopped eating and drinking, hasn't been out of bed for 4 days, picks at the air, muttering incoherently in a morphine delirium. The referral to hospice made, I ask the nurse, can't we try Dilaudid instead? She wasn't like this before they put her on morphine. I'll put in a request, she says, it's worth a try. 3 days later, early in the morning, I walk to the park of scruffy woodland along Little Conestoga Creek, grown over after being mined a century earlier for brickworks clay. Trees just beginning to leaf out, good for spotting bluebird, cardinal, birds of my childhood. Mockingbird's eccentric repertoire making me smile. Warblers I've never seen before, palm, black and white. It feels as though she's with me, she who taught me the names of birds before I could read. In heavy rains, the creek had overflowed its banks, trail still slick with mud. Stepping around one long puddle, I see ripples, three small fish flashing silver. May as well save something this morning, I think. Bend and scoop one up in cupped hands. Slip it back into the creek, then the next, and the third. I suppose it makes no cosmic difference whether those little trout perish with the puddle as it dries, or are swept downstream to be nabbed by a bigger fish or heron. But perhaps one will survive the odds, live to spawn and reproduce its kind. And perhaps it makes no cosmic difference whether my mother at 93, unable to walk, losing her mind, Having asked repeatedly, "Why am I still here? Can't they give me a pill?" dies in a morphine-induced delirium. But when I walk in and see her sitting up in the wheelchair, eating Cheerios and bananas in the common room with Wayne the aide by her side, she gives me a radiant smile. I tell her, "The bluebirds are back." She says, "Well, how about that?" I'm glad it's not yet, not like that, frightened and delirious, but rather another day, having remembered bluebirds. So it turned out to be another day, 3 years later. You know, I think you remember she was swept away by COVID early in the pandemic, May 4th. So that poem is for my mom. And going back to Jane Hirschfield, she says, "In the face of catastrophe, one of the first things you do is stop. Look around, take stock. Weigh the changed conditions in which you now must go forward." I mean, we do that, you know, on the personal scale, and when there's a big loss, you know, a death. We pause, you know, we need to pause and take stock and review our lives and look at the meaning of and how we go forward. And we do it also, you know, collectively when something like this pandemic has occurred. We take stock and we look at how we want to go forward, not just back to so-called normal, but what's important? What are our values? How do we want to live? What have we learned? She says, "A sense of reckoning, emotional, conceptual, and ethical, runs through the pages of her new book." She says, "We who live in a time of alternative facts," in quotes, "and unfounded assertions, can already see the harvest of reality evasion. Thirst for the actual is one reason the language of science has become more present in my life and my poetry. Science's fidelity to clear observation feels needed." So I wanted to read you this one she wrote called "On the Fifth Day," and I meant to find out what the reference to the fifth day is. If it's going back to the biblical creation myth, I meant to check what happened on the fifth day. Does anyone remember? That's all right. We'll check it left afterwards. You'll hear what her point is. "On the fifth day, the scientists who studied the rivers were forbidden to speak or to study the rivers. The scientists who studied the air were told not to speak of the air, and the ones who worked for the farmers were silenced, and the ones who worked for the bees. Someone from deep in the Badlands began posting facts. The facts were told not to speak and were taken away. The facts, surprised to be taken, were silent. Now it was only the rivers that spoke of the rivers, and only the wind that spoke of the bees, while the unpausing factual buds of the fruit trees continued to move toward their fruit. The silence spoke loudly of silence, and the rivers kept speaking of rivers, of boulders and air. Bound to gravity, earless and tongueless, the untested rivers kept speaking. Bus drivers, shelf stockers, code writers, machinists, accountants, lab techs, cellists kept speaking. They spoke the fifth day of silence." I don't know, maybe that fifth day is what started happening after the inauguration. That's another possible reference, but we'd have to check. So those silenced voices are the ones we need to be listening to. And making sure they get heard. So the interviewer talks about how in Hirschfeld's book there's this tension or movement between a sense of doubt and failure and grief, you know, which who hasn't felt this past while, and a sense of possibility, movement, action, speech, this kind of movement and tension between those feelings that we all share, I think. And Hirschfeld replies, "Your question beautifully captures the balancing act of my own psyche these past years. When I contemplate the future, it is hard to feel hopeful. But mystery and keeping a don't-know mind remind me that I cannot know the future. The future will always be a surprise." So yeah, we need to have a humble and open heart, and an ardent, that's a word you don't hear very often, an ardent heart. Ardent in our feeling for this earth and for humanity. So yeah, I thought I'd read her poem about doubt, because chances are, you know, every single one of us has been assailed by doubt, by Mara, the doubt sower. So here's her poem on doubt. It goes, "My doubt." She's addressing doubt, sort of the way the Buddha addressed Mara. "I wake doubt beside you like a curtain half open. I dress doubting like a cup undecided if it has been dropped. I eat doubting, work doubting, go out to a dubious cafe with skeptical friends. I go to sleep doubting myself as a herd of goats sleep in a suddenly gone quiet truck. I dream you doubt nightly, for what is the meaning of dreaming if not that all we are while inside it is transient, amorphous, in question? Left hand and right hand, doubt, you are in me, throwing a basketball, guiding my knife and my fork. Left knee and right knee, we run for a bus, for a meeting that will surely end before we arrive. I would like to grow content in you, doubt, as a double-hung window settles obedient into its hidden pulleys and ropes. I doubt I can do so. Your own counterweight governs my nights and my days. As the knob of hung lead holds steady the open mouth of a window, you hold me. My kneeling before you, resistant, stubborn, offering these furious praises, I can't help but doubt you will ever be able to hear. I should have prepared you for the metaphor she uses. We don't have these, unless you live in some sort of heritage house, we don't have double-hung windows. I'm not even sure what double-hung means, but it's when, you know, in wooden windows, there are ropes and a lead weight holding so that you can open the window, and there's a counterweight that holds the window open. That's what she's talking about. So she's saying, this doubt is my counterweight, right? Very clever. My goodness, how can she think of these things? But doubt, yeah, our companion. I think our practice is really, really helpful for developing a relationship with with Mara, with our doubt, that is not, doesn't have to be as so combative or aversive. Think of it as our counterweight. And then to close, there's this short poem that she writes called My Species. I think many of the poems in this book, I don't have the book yet, but many of them begin with like my doubt, my this, my that. This is My Species. And it's another really surprising metaphor. She says, even a small purple artichoke boiled in its own bittered and darkening waters grows tender and sweet. Patience, I think, my species. Keep testing the spiny leaves, the spiny heart. This is a simple, simple little poem of hope and encouragement that we will grow tender and sweet. That our spininess will soften with patience and the simmering, she doesn't say this, I'm saying it, simmering in our practice, in life itself, we will grow tender. So that's a Poetry Month gift to us from our distant Dharma sister, Jane Hirschfield, to send us into Earth Day coming up. So thank you, everyone. Thank you for listening this morning. Thank you for your practice. Let's chant.